This afternoon, I am interviewing Mr. Robert Eastoffer, who for many years was a librarian at Mount Union College and also the professor of Greek literature, language and literature. I guess it was a Joseph Lorraine Shunk chair of language and literature. And I want to talk with him about his impressions when he first came to Mount Union around the turn of the century and later when he rejoined the college as a librarian and a professor of Greek around 1920, and his impressions over the years, what he would like to say. Well, let's start off first with, how did the college strike you when you first came as a freshman?
Well, I might start by saying that my recollections of Mount Union go back more than half the history of the college, and at least 72 years and possibly 73 or 4 years. I first learned about Mount Union through a high school teacher, Miss Stamble, who later married Judge Schlosser. She got me interested in Mount Union, and it was convenient. I had an offer of a scholarship from Ohio Wesleyan, but the fees at Ohio Wesleyan were higher than a scholarship, so although Mount Union had discontinued scholarships at the time that I enrolled, I decided it would be cheaper to go to Mount Union than go to Ohio Wesleyan.
Now, you were at Kent at this time,
is that right? At Kent, yes.
And was there a Kent Normal at that time?
No, Kent State or Kent Normal had not been founded yet. It was several years after I graduated before. Probably I would have gone there because that would have been much less expense.
Now, you're talking about what year when you came?
Well, I matriculated in 1902, and I knew about Mount Union about 1900. And I recall very vividly coming to Mount Union and going to Dr. Shunk, and he was the one who first got me a room. He took me down State Street, and he stopped at several houses along the way where they took student roomers. And we passed several, and no one wanted to take anybody. But finally, we reached the Wickershams, who lived in an old house next to the railroad. And they took me in, and I stayed there for a year. I did my own cooking. My father was a grocer, and I got groceries cheap, and cheaper than I would have. But the next year, I organized a boarding club. And that was the way I made my expenses through college.
And where did you have the boarding club?
Well, there were several people. The first one, I waited on table at one with the, Mrs. Corns, I think, had one. And
this was Professor Corns.
Professor Corns, yes, wife. And Mrs. Quick before that, I waited at table at her place. Then I organized this club, and my supporters were chiefly those from two fraternities, because I had pledged to Sigma Nu's, and they seemed to be very chummy with the Alpha Psi Deltas at that time. So that those two fraternity and sorority supported me and were my boarders. Mrs. Chain was a very good one. I won't mention all of these where I had the club, but she was a very neat person, and she was hospitable, and we had a very good club there. We had about 34 members.
Now, you'd have breakfast, lunch, and dinner, or
yeah, we usually had the heavier meal at noon.
I see.
We often had steak for breakfast.
Oh.
She had some heart condition, though, and she finally had to give it up. And then Dr. Riker induced Harry Myers and me. I had taken him in as my partner. He induced us to go to take charge of the dining room at Miller Hall. I advised against it because the number of boarders was not enough to make it remunerated. And I felt that the overhead would swallow up any profits that we might make, and it turned out to be that way. two fraternities that had been boarding there absconded and wouldn't stay with us, but I was fortunate in having the seminaries and Alvesy Dollars stand by me. Well, I won't go into a long detail about that, but it was a great advantage to me to join the fraternity, because they were really very faithful to me. I wouldn't go into an evaluation of fraternities today relative to what they were worth at that time, but to me at that time, the fraternity was a big asset. Mm-hmm.
Now, where was the house? Was it on the corner of Union and College?
Yes, the old brick, as they call it.
Call it the old red brick. That's where the chicken place is now. Mm-hmm. And just go back a minute, when you were running the boarding club, what were your duties? What did you do to...
Well, I planned the meals, and I did all the buying. Mm-hmm. And I paid the woman who took us into her home and did the cooking 50 cents a head, which isn't very much, but we only charged $2.50 for a week for meat, for board. It's unbelievable.
It is.
Isn't
it? That is.
And we even gave them a refund if they went away for the weekend.
Well, it's a wonder you made any money on that kind of a margin.
Well, tuition was only $15 a term, so expenses were very low.
Things were more relative in terms of that.
Yeah.
Well, then, did you stay at the fraternity house once you became a member?
Yes, the second year, much to the disappointment and chagrin of the Wickershams where I lived, they thought I was making a big mistake. I joined the fraternity and went to live at the fraternity house, and I enjoyed that very much, and this fellowship. Then the last year, my senior year, the Wickershams asked me to come back. They said they wouldn't charge me any board roommate if I'd just come back and stay with them. And I did that and got free rent.
You said their house was next to the railroad track on State
Street?
That
house was moved. They built a house while I was a student. And when I returned to live with them, they were living in their new house. The old house was moved onto Hartshorn Street in the southwest corner. I think you know where it is. They used to call it the nunnery.
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think it's still there.
Yes, it's still there. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, how did you find your classes and your professors as you started?
Well, I have always felt that, considering the size of the faculty, that Mount Union has never had a stronger faculty. Now, I suppose it's impossible to make a very accurate evaluation, but I think it would be pretty hard to find a faculty of a small college that had a higher percentage of high-grade teachers than Mount Union had at that time. There was Shock, who had a fine reputation. Professor Messick, who later went to Ohio Wesleyan.
Professor Messick was in Latin.
Yeah, in Latin.
Yes.
Shock in Greek. And Professor Gibbs, he was there 2 years while I was a student. It was another person who was the head of the English department part of the time. And Professor Webster.
He was history?
History. And Yanni in mathematics. He went to Worcester. And Lee, who taught chemistry and later went to Allegheny. They all went to schools which at that time had better resources than Mount Union did. And I found every one of them very profitable, very contributing a great deal to my education. I've often thought about recent times, students being very, very critical of their professors. I have a feeling that at least I was never quite so critical, and I don't know if the student body as a whole was as critical of students then as they are today. I think they lampooned their physical eccentricities more, and even that got into print sometimes, and it wasn't very pleasant.
I recall seeing some about Dr. Yes. Riker, who yes. they seemed to delight in doing that too.
It got into the Unonian, and the year before I enrolled at Mount Union, there was a very serious trouble, and one student who was a senior was deprived of his diploma. At least he never got it until several years later. He finally relented, I think, in the future. And
I remember Professor Yanni one time told me about that incident. According to him, I think it was in the commencement line or right at commencement time, and he was pulled out of the... It was that far
yes.
along.
The Lipschitz told me a great deal about it, and it involved the taking of the cowl belonging to the president up onto the second floor of the Miller Hall. And it was quite a case.
Now, President Riker at that time lived where Cope Music Hall now is,
yeah,
where the
yeah,
old conservatory
yeah,
used
right.
to be.
Right.
And the other buildings on campus would be what when you were a student?
There were really only, besides that, there were really only three buildings. The Morgan Gymnasium, of course, Chapman Hall, the first, Miller Hall, and Morgan Gymnasium. And they were all in rather run-down condition.
Do you recall the old seminary building? It used to be at the corner of Hartshorn and Altman there.
No.
I didn't know they were still there. It was an old frame building. It was pretty dilapidated, and it was torn or moved, I guess.
Well, wasn't it on a spot where the garden?
Yes, in that area
the park,
there.
The
yes.
Park is.
The Founders Park.
Founders Park.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think they say that at certain times you can see the, in dry weather, you can see the impression.
The foundation.
The foundation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, all the old time, the Founders, that is Clark and the Hartshorns, they were gone by the time.
The Hartshorns were gone. I remember Dr. Marsh. I have a recollection of six of the seven presidents of Mount Union. A very personal recollection of five, starting with Dr. Rogers. Dr. Marsh was in a wheelchair when I went to Mount Union. He was being wheeled around. I remember he was going to church, and he didn't go to college, much that I remember. But he was paralyzed. He was confined in a wheelchair. But Dr. Riker was the president when I was a student. And I've always felt that he never got quite the credit he should have for building up a good faculty. Of course, Mount Union was in the doldrums so far as financial matters are concerned, and so far as the enrollment is concerned. And trustees got very impatient with it. The city was just on the brink of getting the Carnegie grant, and of course he was released,
yes.
His resignation was forced. But I appreciated him. He was a very good speaker, rather able speaker. And in building up the faculty, I think he was, showed good judgment.
I remember one time I talked with Dr. Yanni. That's when he was retired and at Worcester. I went over to see him, and he said that when Dr. Riker came, there was another man by the name of Frank Lockwood who came in English. He was only there a year. And he said the feeling of the faculty at that time was the role should have been reversed, that he felt Lockwood was urbane and gentlemanly, quite worldly wise, sophisticated, that he should have been the president and Riker should have been the professor of religion or
yeah,
something. It should just been reversed. But he said Lockwood later, I believe, went to the Southwest, wrote a number of books, became
he went to Allegheny first.
Was it?
Yes, Yes, he was quite liberal, as I recall, in his religious outlook, too. Maybe he would have been too liberal for my
at that time,
at that
probably,
time.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, he wrote, too. He was productive in that way.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, now you came back And you left about 1906 when you graduated. Yeah. About 15 years later, 1920 actually, wasn't it?
Yes.
You came back. What was your impression? Had you, what, was there a great change, particularly?
Well, in the physical aspects, there wasn't too much. Mount Union was on the rebound, so far as enrollment is concerned. You see, it had sunk to a very low ebb. There were 17 in my graduating class, and then about two or three years later, in the very first years of Dr. McMaster's presidency, I think the graduation, the number of graduates has sunk to 7 or 8. Maybe it might have been 11, but it was not more than a dozen, I know. And he was just beginning to generate more interest in the college and to get people to send their children and beginning to get some financial help. He finally succeeded in getting a Carnegie grant, $50,000. But so far as the physical plant is concerned, the only additions that had been made were Elliott Hall and Lamborn Hall, Lamborn Science Hall. And the first year that I was there, the Memorial Hall was in the process of being erected. I think even at that time they felt it was kind of a blunder in a way.
Yes.
I remember particularly Miss Stanball came back to commencement commenting about it. It didn't seem to have much architectural refinement. And,
well, it was a basketball court, and
yeah,
this is what
I
the...
Whether they realized then the
yeah.
poor acoustics
it
yeah. just had, you know.
But I think this was the moving force, was to get a basketball
yeah.
uh-huh. court.
There was some discontent, too, among the townspeople that it wasn't made more available. It was supposed to be a memorial for all the men who were engaged in the First World War. And I think their expectations were too high, the expectations of the citizens.
Mm-hmm.
The college just could not let it out, you know,
yes.
for use any time. And they had to reserve it for their own use.
Now, you came back under the the pressure, the inducement, the attraction. It was a Dr. Shunk, was a President McMaster. You had other opportunities, and you
yes.
were teaching at that time.
Well, I was at New York Public Library at the time, and Dr. Shunk was getting ready to retire. And he asked Dr. McMaster whom he would like to have as his successor. And Dr. Shunk mentioned me. And he said, well, where is he? It showed that I hadn't kept too close to
yeah.
in touch with the college. And he says, well, he's out in New York, Public Library. I was kept in correspondence with Dr. Shunk. So Dr. McMaster wrote to me when he and Mr. Dunn couldn't come out for an interview, and they came out and found me there in the Public Library. I was getting rather impatient with the situation in the New York system, and also we were not too happy living in New York. We wanted to get out into a place where we had more space for the boys to grow up. So. They induced me to come to Mount. Well, I got an offer of an increase since I got the inducement. And I said, no, it isn't a question of salary so much, although salaries were very low then. But we want to raise our boys in somewhat better, freer,
yes.
more roomy atmosphere than New York City. And I had a chance to join the staff of the Huntington Library just about that time, too. And Dr. Weil, who was the head of the library school and director of the New York State Library, it rather disgusted me that I wouldn't accept it. And I told him, well, we had just returned from Oregon a couple of years ago in order that we might be a little nearer our parents, and I didn't see why we should turn around and move back to Los Angeles in that vicinity. And he said, well, I think they pay your moving expenses if you go. But it's hard to know whether you made a mistake or not. I don't think so.
No, I don't know all the factors involved, but it always seemed to me it was a good decision.
Well, I have not appreciated quite so much association with big institutions. I think you lose something of the personal touch. And of course, we had that in the
years.
There's a lot of bureaucracy, and it might not have been so bad in Huntington.
At that time, yes.
In the New York Public. There were 600 employees in that one building. And the director never came into contact directly with any of these employees. He had a go-between that he sent around. And salaries were very low for living in a big city. They increased me a couple of times. And I could tell you more about that. But
yes. No, not
for this interview.
That's right. Yes. Well, of course, you came back. You taught English the first year, I believe,
yes,
didn't you?
Yes.
Until Dr. Shunk actually retired.
I taught English at West Virginia Wesleyan, and then I taught at Willamette for 2 years in English. And when I was invited to return to Mount Union, Dr. McMaster offered me the position as associate professor of English and librarian. Professor Martin was in charge of the English department then, but he suddenly resigned in the middle of the year, or in the summer. And so Dr. McMaster then asked me to take over as head of the department. The understanding was as soon as Dr. Shunk resigned, I would transfer to Greek, which would be a little easier because there were more students in
English. Yes.
But I hadn't expected him to do it that next year. He was still vigorous enough to teach, and I was a little astonished that he resigned. But he said he'd taught for 44 years, and he was 77 years old, and so he decided to retire.
This is not in connection with the college, but and some other historical research that I was doing. He was president, of course, of the First National Bank in Alliance for a number of years around the turn of the century. And in doing that history of the bank, he suddenly resigned. Oh, I don't know, 1904 or 1905, somewhere along there. And the minutes, of course, and the records don't indicate. They just indicate the resignation. He just suddenly resigned, and he had some stock, and I noticed that it was sold. And I wondered why, if he ever indicated why he suddenly gave up his connection.
I never heard.
With that.
I never knew. In fact, I never could quite understand why he was president. He was president of the board.
Yes, he was president of the board.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Because he never was a money maker. He didn't leave much of an estate. And
well, I think at that time the your resources of the bank, of course, were
smaller,
yeah. And it may be that this was distasteful to
him.
Well,
he was a very shrewd person, in a way. And although I thought he wasn't too shrewd in building that house, a fairly large house,
yes.
And he evidently expected it to be the future residence of the president of the college, and
wanted to
live
there. You're speaking about the house that used to be at the corner of Shunk and State Street,
uh-huh.
Where the shopping
right.
center
uh-huh.
is. And he called that a certain name, Eureta Place, was it?
Yes.
And what was this?
He named after his wife.
After his wife.
You remember?
Yes, I remember that place, and I think when I was a student here, there were some faculty who talked about, I remember Eric Eckler saying they ought to have a faculty club, and that would be a good faculty club there. But there were not funds for it, of course.
They had a cooperative student team.
Yes, I think when Dr. Ketchum came, they used it for dormitory facilities then.
Yeah.
And then, of course, later it was purchased and torn down.
Well, one of those things that It's like the Shakespeare Garden. I always felt rather sad that that had to be abandoned, because so many people put, and particularly, what was your name, Mrs.
Shimp,
put so much effort into that, and the gardener.
Mr. Halsall.
Halsall,
yes.
Englishman.
Yes, I used to recall as a student going over and asking what a certain shrub or a little flower was, that he could quote the play and the act and the line, you know. Yeah. It was always interesting to hear. I mean, he had a little twang with his little accent. Yeah. Well, to get to the part that you are associated, at least primarily, with the library, what was your reaction after coming to New York Public and seeing the Mount Union College Library?
Well, it was... it's hard to express it. I was almost appalled at the task. Although the library was small, there was a large collection of uncatalogued books, and the state of the catalog itself was horrible. There were cards in the catalog that didn't, for which there were no books on the shelves, and there were books on the shelves for which there were no cards in the catalog, and the physical conditions were very deleterious. The dirt from the furnace in the basement was very bad, and the place was overrun by vermin and rodents, and all those things together. And the fact that the books were shelved two rows deep, first thing I did was to get a decent catalog and to recatalog the whole collection and abandon things for which there were duplicates. And I had to work almost single-handed the first year, and the document master promised me a trained assistant, but they didn't offer enough money to get one. But the second year I was able to get Miss Patterson to come from Freedom Public Library, and she was an invaluable aid. We proceeded rather rapidly then to recatalog the books and to discard all those that were without any great value. The weakest part of the library, I think, was the reference collection. There was practically no reference collection and no bibliographical tools to work with. And we got the Mount Union College Women's Club to contribute some money, and with that I was able to buy the United States Catalog and some other reference tools, so that we begin to have a basis for cataloging and for buying.
And now, the library was, the reading room was on the west side of the Chapman Hall.
Yes, it was on the west side.
And then you used the stacks downstairs, the basement for stacks.
The basement was given over largely to government documents, and they were in a deplorable state. The backs of the unbound ones had been eaten off of the rats and mice, and the serial collection was unlisted. Mm-hmm. I got some students to help me on that, and they began to list those. And as I said, there was a big stack of duplicates in uncatalogued books down there, chiefly religious books given by ministers who had been former students in our union. And we discarded a great many of those. I really looked like a miner every day when I was home. Then we made some progress, and I talked to Mr. Carr about the appropriation of the college. The first year I was at Mount Union, the appropriation for the library was $1,800.
$1,800.
That's all. For everything.
Everything.
And I said, you can't build up a library with anything like that. He said, well, I think that the trustees will do better when you show them what is necessary. And I had good support from Dr. McMaster. Of course, I couldn't expect too much, because the college was running on a shoestring, you know, so. But we did get organized, and finally in 1930, that was 10 years after I went, we were examined by that Carnegie committee. The Carnegie Foundation was giving out funds at that time to different colleges, and I didn't know whether we'd be able to qualify or not. Our physical condition was so bad. But they did commend us for the organization, and we got $10,000 at that time, which was quite a boon to us.
That was.
It was to be spent over a period, I think, of 3 years. And then they were also offering money for the purchase of books and materials in the field of art, and then in the field of music. And Mrs. Peasley, who was then in California, offered to pay half of the necessary fund. That was the requirement of the Carnegie Corporation.
It had to be matching.
Yeah, it had $2,500, and they would give $2,500. She gave an extra $1,000. We really had $6,000. So within a very short space of time, we got $16,000 for books. And then in addition to that, we got $2,500 more for music collection, for records and books. So it was fairly close to $20,000. And we began to get other gifts and some memorial gifts. But it doesn't correspond to what you've been getting
no.
in recent years.
That's true.
And
of course, I feel that with, I've written several memos to the dean, the president, the prices of books nowadays have just the inflation and the budget. It's you
Eat
get caught.
The advances,
yes, it's just tremendous. Many books are $35, $40 just a single book now.
It really deters the single individual buying books.
Yes.
If you buy paperbacks, you can get them cheaper, but even they have gone up in price.
That's true.
They cost about as much as an ordinary book did before.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, now you taught Greek language and literature when there was a demand for that. You also offered, you were interested in art. I know you offered Greek art and just a regular appreciation.
I offered Greek art, Greek history, and a course called Classical Heritage, which was a study of some of the works of Greek literature in translation. And in that course, I tried to broaden it so as to relate it to modern literature. Many of the modern writers, and particularly among some of the modern French writers, they had gone back to the ancient Greek for themes and inspiration, and I thought it should be of interest to students in other departments. I've been sorry they don't carry that on. Are they offering anything at all?
Yes, they are. They have two courses they offer in the classics, the appreciation of the classics now. They're trying to work with that.
I took over the Latin, too, after they asked the Latin man to resign. They felt the enrollment was small, and I hated to see it completely omitted from the curriculum. So I said, well, I'll at least teach one course. I finally taught two.
Now, this was at what time?
Well, this was very near the end of my tenure.
This was after Murphy and then the man who had been president of the college in the South, Dr. Key, was in the classic.
It was after he was.
Was after Dr. Bali, was it?
And there was the man from, I can't recall his name now. He went, as I understand it, to Puerto Rico.
Oh, yes. He was from the University of Michigan.
Yeah. What was his name?
The name slips me.
He only stayed
about
1 year. So I took it over. I even taught a course in current affairs 1 year. And I guess I've dabbled in a good many things.
Well, I think the way things are going now, I was talking with some of the younger faculty who very much feel they're spatialists, indicating that in the early years and during the Depression, many of the faculty doubled in brass, and we may be doing that again.
Might be.
Oh, yes, I think so, with the problem of enrollment.
Well, it has, of course, its advantages and disadvantages, but I'll tell you, sometimes it puts you on your mettle.
Yes.
And when I taught English, I never had had a course in Browning. But I got busy, and I studied Browning. And I always felt that I knew Browning as well as I did almost any other English author. Mm-hmm. Although I'd had special courses in Shakespeare and Chaucer and in the universities. And you can do an immense amount on your own if you really have the resolution to do it. There may be some fields where it's more difficult than others.
This is true. Well, now I know you were a great warm admirer of the President McMaster, and of course he had the type of personality which really did appeal to so many.
Well, I think Dr. McMaster was present when I came, and that would be one reason for my feeling a warm attachment to him. And he did always encourage me a great deal in the work. He knew I was, rather disappointed in some ways, and was waiting and waiting for a new library building.
Yes.
And it was a great grief to him that he was not able to secure that. And I never shall forget the day that he offered his resignation. The faculty were called into session, and it was a time of homecoming, and I had not been conscious of the fact that his resignation really had been forced, but he got up, asked him to make a statement, and he spoke about that he had always told the trustees that any time they wanted his resignation, that it was in their hands. And after the meeting, people began to talk about it being forced out. And I said, well, he wasn't forced out. I was very innocent of it. And well, they said he was. And then the truth began to dawn on me.
Mm-hmm.
His resignation had been asked by the trustees. Of course, he'd been there 30 years, and in the course of that length of time, you may have a lot of friends, but you make some opponents and enemies, and probably his time was up.
Now, I can recall as a student, the reference to Professor Stauffer was always one of great scholarly respect, and they always referred to you as Mr. Stauffer, Professor Stauffer, and it always seemed, the people would smile this a bit, because McMaster would get so exuberant that he'd say, now I'm going to see these gentlemen, and I'm going to get that library for Bobby Stauffer. And I know that always struck, people have to sort of smile, they said, that's just McMaster getting carried away. But it was more, he knew you so familiarly, and he referred to you as Bobby Stauffer.
Yeah,
but I know this is true. He mentioned this. This was one of the things he wanted to do.
I used to be a little bit embarrassed sometimes because he gave me so much praise.
Mm-hmm.
And did it publicly, and I would have felt a little easier if he hadn't done it so much, because I think that there were so many people, of course he always gave Dr. Scott a great deal of praise to me, and there were others who were contributing just as much, but of course I don't know why he seemed to feel, he was so interested in the library.
Well, I think this is true, he liked books, and I think he appreciated what you had done and what this meant.
Well, I feel as if each president has had a great deal to contribute. And,
in his way, yes.
Came along, the financial situation was becoming rather serious, and under Dr. Ketchum began to get more funds, and he established a good relationship with the conferences.
Yes.
And then they had Mr. Schiltz as president of the board, and he put it on a sound financial basis. And then under Bracy, of course, and under George King, I think perhaps more than almost any single individual is responsible for the material.
The recent.
That's my own feeling. Yes. Now, maybe others don't feel that way. But,
no, I think, I think this is true.
The Board of Trustees, things began to move.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. I suppose to go back, you would concur with a great many others that Dean Bowman was a man of sterling qualities and integrity.
And the longer you knew him, the more you appreciated him. Mm-hmm. I didn't appreciate him quite so much at first. I thought he was a little provincial, but he was some little conscious of that too, I think. But he had some basic characteristics and qualities that were very much in need mm-hmm. at the time. And I learned to respect him very highly.
You think of any others as you sort of flash back like
well,
that you would pick out?
I could speak of different ones. And one, some that you wouldn't know. Professor Judd was a very delightful professor to me.
You're talking about your student days now.
Yeah, my student days. He was a graduate, he studied at a German university, had a sound training in psychology, also taught religion. But he had a humorous side to him that I liked very much. And I felt a sort of freedom in his class that perhaps I didn't feel in every class. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but Lee was rather stern. You couldn't fall asleep in his class, or in Dr. Shunk's class, for that matter.
Yes, I've heard that about Dr. Shunk. People trembled if they weren't prepared when they went to his class.
Yes. Messick, I always felt, was one of the most urbane and erudite of the professors that I had. It seems as though he could talk about calculus and things in mathematics and other fields besides Latin. As if he was perfectly familiar with those subjects. And he gave me a feeling of the unity of knowledge that I think almost no other professor ever gave me, even some of my university professors, mm-hmm. although I got that feeling at the university, particularly in the interrelationship in a certain discipline or field, but not perhaps interdisciplinary.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I had heard others speak of this, that he was, he came through in this fashion.
Yeah. He could get very excited, but there was a period there when there seemed to be some cheating going on. He got very much upset about that. I remember one class, we were having an examination, and he made us sit two seats apart, everybody. Mm-hmm. Let anybody sit next to somebody else.
I recall years ago seeing an alumni questionnaire in which his wife, Mrs. Messick, indicated the most memorable thing that happened to you in college. She said, there was a day of my graduation when I married my favorite professor, and that's when she became Mrs. Messick.
I think some of their days are a little bit stormy from the night.
Oh, is that right? Yes. I didn't know. I just remember that. Yeah. Remember that quip.
Yeah. I think that Mount Union has... aside from one period where it was in the doldrums, it's had a rather steady evolutionary development. It seems to me that one could say that. And in recent days, it has, of course, some serious problems, as all colleges have. But I think Mount Union has weathered that about as well as any small college could be expected to do.
As you look back, of course, you take a great deal of pride and satisfaction in the way the library has developed, and you say the way that the college has evolved. I suppose the only regret you have is the lack of emphasis on the classics today.
That would be my chief regret, yes. Mm-hmm. It's not peculiar to Mount Union alone, but to a number of...